Greetings, everyone. Welcome to another Wednesday evening with the Clear Mountain Monastery community. This evening, we are very excited and honored to have Gil Fronsdale join us. Gil, thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here with the two of you and with all your friends.
Yeah. There's a lot of good people tuning in, and people will watch it later as well. I'll just start off reading a short biography and then jump into questions. So, and people are welcome to put questions in the chat at any point. And we'll open it up to those questions in about half an hour or so. So Gil Fronsdale is the founding teacher and a co-guiding teacher at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California, and the Insight Retreat Center in Santa Cruz, California. He has been teaching since 1990. Gil has practiced Zen and Vipassana since 1975 and has a PhD in Buddhist studies from Stanford. He is a husband and a father of two boys. So, Gil, the first time I met you was in 2007. I had been living at a monastery and I really wanted to ordain, but it didn't work out for me there. And my mother had just moved to Palo Alto, so somewhat close to IMC, and I just randomly reached out, sent an email to someone at IMC, and they connected with me with you. And within a week, you kind of took out, you didn't know me from anybody else. And you took the time, I think you had family, maybe your mother was visiting, and you just took the time to walk around the block and talk about the benefits of being a monastic or being a layperson. That was kind of what my question was all about. So I've been following you and grateful ever since then. So, yeah, a little bit of my backstory. And in the last week or so, I've really been trying to get my fill of Gil and have been listening to hours and hours of your Dhamma talks and reading many of your essays, of which there are lots. So one essay that you have in a book called Secularizing Buddhism, which is a really interesting read, is called Naturalistic Buddhism. And in that essay, you talk about how that sometimes when you're asked how you identify as a Buddhist or how you identify as a teacher, you'll say as a naturalistic Buddhist. So what does that mean?
Okay. Well, it's not exactly, starting with not exactly probably what you mean by the question, but what it means about writing that in the article is that I believe that that's useful for people who listen to a teacher at some point to let the teacher identify themselves, locate themselves, kind of their spiritual location. And it's a little bit of a borrowing a term that's now happening a little bit in the DEI world, that it's useful to do a social location, be conscious of your social location. I think it's useful to be explicit about spiritual location, where you are, what you believe, where you fit in the tradition, so that when people come and listen to your teaching, my teaching, I'm accountable to it. They know what I'm about. They know what I'm doing. They know why I'm doing what I'm doing. And then they can question it. They can say, well, how does that fit? And that's different than other people. And because, I consider myself a Theravadan Buddhist, but there's a lot of different types of Theravadan Buddhists. And some Theravadan Buddhism is pretty amazing. And so amazing that I probably wouldn't get involved with it. And Theravadan Buddhism changes all the time. This amazing story that kind of your tradition, as I understand it, maybe you probably studied this or know more about this than I do. But, in the 1800s in Thailand, the ecclesiastical authorities, the senior monks in Thailand, didn't believe it was possible to have any attainment of an awakening. And then it was really Ajahn Mun and his, Ajahn Sao, I think, who really kind of pushed that envelope. And even up until the 1950s, the ecclesiastical authorities in Bangkok were just dismissing the possibility of any kind of level of enlightenment. And this is surprising for people who are introduced to the West, to Buddhism, these days, where it's kind of taken for granted that these are possible and people are experiencing them. If you go to Burma like I did, stream entry was a common kind of expectation experience. But 200 years ago, this was not considered possible. It's an example of how Theravadan Buddhism has changed and is changing all the time. So whether I like it or not, as a participant in the tradition, I have to be honest, I have to be truthful to myself and make it work for who I am. And I don't want to say that my interpretation, my take is the way it has to be. But I also don't want to avoid and not talking about my understanding, because there's no one else's understanding really. I mean, it's someone's understanding. And, there's not like a orthodoxy. I know enough to know there's not an orthodoxy, which is the pure Theravadan Buddhism. And so whose Theravadan Buddhism do we teach? And, we'll go back and study the suttas, and that'll tell us exactly what it is. I've spent years studying the suttas, and I can tell you that mostly what we have is interpretations of what's in the suttas. And, so one way to, for me, realizing this or having this orientation or seeing this as what's going on in the tradition, I thought it was really good to really clearly state, this is my background, these are the influences on me, this is my take. And so for me, naturalistic Buddhism is the best way, simplest way to describe, I thought, myself. I thought it was good to have a label to help out. And I kind of made it up, I thought. Until then, after that book was published, where Bhikkhu Bodhi has also an essay where he a little bit criticizes me, he uses the word imminent Buddhist, right? That that was kind of fun, and then but in the late 80s, he had just used naturalistic Buddhism to describe some of these Western insight teachers like myself. So he already had coined that word. So I guess he felt he had to come up. Maybe it was respectful. He was trying to respect me by coming up with a different word. And I don't know what was going on, but and it's a lot of influences that come to me that this is my orientation, and I want to just be explicit about it in some places. I'm not going to be explicit to an introduction to Buddhism class that I teach or something. But there are times, so that essay is one of the places where I'm quite explicit. And I'm hoping that helps people understand me, understands where I fit, and can question me easier, can decide for themselves better. And, you know, one of the things that happens in Buddhism as a teacher, if I say X and Y, people assume that I'm also believing in Z. There's a lot of leaps that people make, and assuming that, they have some idea what Buddhism is, and all Buddhist teachers must be alike. And so if I say X and Y, it must mean Z too. And so I think there's some value in just being really explicit about all this. And my hope is in this kind of really honesty and being explicit, rather than tying us into debates and tying us into dogma and what's right or wrong, it's a stepping stone to let go of holding on to views and holding on, being attached to, views about even Buddhism. That freedom is a bit more important calling card for Buddhism, or it's a much more important phenomena. And so the reference point for the Buddhism I like to teach, which I think is relatively standard, I would hope, is the idea that it all leads to the same place. It all ultimately leads to Nibbana, the deathless, to release, to freedom. Yeah. And that's the, and so maybe there's many, many points of view that lead there. So maybe I'm permitted to do it a little bit uniquely.
Yeah, no, it's, I love the article. I thought you described your take on Theravada and your perspective really wonderfully, and there's a lot of resonance in many ways in how I think both of us approach the Dhamma as well. Could you say more specifically about that term? I think it is a naturalistic Buddhism. It's a term which will be unfamiliar to enough people that it might be good to describe what it means.
Yeah. So, you know, even though I coined the term, I'm not a philosopher. It is that there is that the adjective is used like for something called naturalistic philosophy, naturalistic religion. So it is used more widely. And so I should have probably studied up really well how it's used in these contexts. But the way I define it in the article, it's a Buddhism that relies on the natural laws as we know them now.
Hmm.
And so it wouldn't be involved with something which doesn't fit into the natural laws as we know them. And so for example, there are supernatural beliefs in Buddhism. You know, and it was, for example, this belief in heaven and hell. And some Western Buddhists just simply ignore all that, you know, and are happy not to think about it. And so I'm one of those in a sense. and so I'm more interested in the naturalistic, you know, what's here and now. That's, you know, I didn't know whether to take Bhikkhu Bodhi's reference to me as imminent Buddhist as a criticism or praise.
I think I like the term in a lot of ways. And also I'm curious about if you pointing to that aspect of transcendence on the path, which I think even a naturalistic Buddhist perspective encompasses, and where we're speaking about all these different traditions and how there's all these different viewpoints, but it seems like they all are mapping out the same territory, and two key landmarks in that landscape are, I would think, the experience of jhana and a stream entry of the first glimpse of awakening. So I'm curious, when people come to you with so many different views about what those terms even mean and ideas, how do you tell whether an experience of jhana and stream entry is authentic and real as you define it? And what have you seen in that realm?
Yes. So there are things that I'll speak with some confidence about. I don't feel so, I don't know if confidence is the right word, but, you know, these two topics is not something that I feel that I want to kind of hold forth with a definitive understanding. But it's a good question. And, I think that, samadhi is really important. I'm not so oriented around using the word jhana and talking about people going through the four jhanas. But I value it tremendously. I think they're really important states. I'm more interested in the experience of absorption, the experience of settling, and the process to move to deeper and deeper states. And what seems to happen is that there's a range of intensities by which people can go into samadhi, and a range of intensities in which jhanic factors can operate and other factors can happen. And there's a range of things which qualifies a nimitta for samadhi, for jhana. And so rather than narrowing down one way, or that it's, some people say it's only if it's super intense, you know, that it's real jhana. And so I'm just interested if the concentration is strong enough for stream entry.
Hmm.
And some people say, well, it has to be jhana. There has to be some jhana for that to happen. And then the question is, you know, yes, but how do you define jhana? Lee Brazington uses the term jhana light and jhana heavy. And his way of analyzing dozens of different jhana teachers. And so for me, when I went through the Mahasi practice, which is in Burma, the rhetoric of it is, this is not concentration. This is not jhana practice. What we went through is vipassana jhanas. But vipassana jhanas go through the same sequence and the same jhanic factors. It's just, I guess, because it's not intense enough to fit into the Visuddhi Magga. Mm. They call it vipassana jhanas. I suspect that what they call vipassana jhanas in Burma is sutta jhanas in the suttas, what the Buddha talked about. Hmm. And I think Tanisara Bhikkhu also has seen that he's tried to heal this tremendous divide between mindfulness, vipassana, and jhana, and say these are integrated. And I see it that way, too. I feel it's very important people develop a lot of concentration. Too many people who are in the insight meditation movement do a kind of mindfulness that doesn't really allow them to get deeply absorbed. And somehow the teaching sometimes interfere with that and different things. But I really want to see, I want to develop a lot of concentration, but I don't want to make it presented in a way that it looks like anything particular that I'm expecting, rather supporting for each individual their own way through this. And I see a lot of individual variations. And then to support people, and some people are really into the concentration, and I'll support them as far as that seems to go with them. And some people are into more mindfulness. But ideally, when I teach, I'm trying to combine the two and see there's a simultaneous growth of both mindfulness and samadhi and unification. And so I don't know if this is a satisfying answer. I apologize, I'm so long-winded. But I didn't even get the stream injury.
Well, maybe we can circle back around. I think the way that you answered is quite skillful. It's somewhat in line with one of your essays is called A Broader Church, where you talk about, you know, different people come to you with different needs. You know, some people have a full family and a full-time job, and they don't actually want anything about Buddhism. They just want to get a little peace in their lives. And then you've got other people who come and are intent on the jhanas, are intent on liberation, you know, in this very life. And I think maybe that speaks something to, you know, that you have both the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City and the Insight Retreat Center where people can go deeper. Could you talk about just this range of people who the different aspects of your teachings and your centers touch, and how people can tap into those?
Yeah. So you'll probably, you know, you forgive me if I, you know, answer my idiosyncratic way. And you can always ask again. The decision I made many years ago initially it was to become a Zen Buddhist priest, but to dedicate my life to Buddhism was to dedicate my life to a life that met suffering in the world, to try to make a difference there. I wanted to address and live a life that somehow addressed the roots of suffering. And the only way I knew how to do that was through Buddhism. And but it was address suffering. It wasn't so much a decision, but as I had done my practice, the sense of holding myself apart from the suffering of the world dissolved. And other people's suffering was almost the same as my own. The idea that it's my, you know, that's them versus me didn't make so much sense anymore. If I'm suffering, I should care for myself. If my neighbor is suffering, I should care for my neighbor. And whoever's suffering the most, that's where my attention goes, kind of. And so I had no basis to separate out who gets that attention, whether it's me or others, at some point. So when I became a Buddhist teacher, an insight teacher, one of the characteristics of that was I had no basis to say no to anyone who came. And so lots of people come and ask. And at some point when I started getting really busy with lots of people talking to me, people said, Gil, you have to start saying no to some people. Only see, I don't know what the people who are serious, or I don't know what they were suggesting, but you're more experienced students or something. And I just couldn't see how I could do that because I couldn't live in a divided world. I just wanted to say yes to wherever suffering is met. So the doors are open at IMC. And so we get a wide range of people coming. And we get people who are brand new. And we had people there today who had never meditated before and didn't even know what Buddhism was really. And they're maybe trying to cope with a difficult life. And then we have people who have been monastics, who are monastics maybe, and who've done decades of practice and deep practice in Asia, here in this country, and I just want to say yes to them all, and figure out how to support them where they are at, so that's been a characteristic then. So at IMC, which is an urban community meditation center, that's where we get people just walking off the street. And we get the wide range of concerns, of suffering people have, and I'm happy sometimes just to help people cope better with a difficult life. I don't feel like I need people to become Buddhist or go all the way to stream mentoring. I just want to meet them as they are and offer what's supportive now. But then we have a retreat center, in September I'll do a 3-week retreat, and next year will be a month long retreat in September, and that's where the senior practitioners come, and there's a requirements of doing a lot of practice to be able to get into that, and there I'm guiding people in really deep practice and supporting that, and that's kind of the context for it. But even there I try to be very careful, because we can have people who at IMC who in some ways are fairly mature, they're not getting concentrated, they're not going into these deep states, and who am I to say they should? So I want to be very careful to not present like this is how it's supposed to be, but I want to put it in a way, even for the deep practitioners, in a way that's broad enough that it can meet the needs of people at different states of their life. And so that's an art form to do that, and whether how well I do it, I don't know. But it leads to it sometimes not being so absolutely specific. Because then leave some people out.
So to venture into specificity a bit, I imagine some people will hear, you know, you speak about this range of practice and practitioner, and we have a lot of community members and know many who they really do on a profound level intuit the power of this path, and they find their lives for various reasons, job or family or other conditions, just the alignment is never quite right. There's a sense of never quite having their life as aligned with that dharmic aspiration as they would hope. And as someone who spent, you know, a decade at a monastery like yourself and then has moved into a lay life, what guidance would you give them? Would you give someone who's really sincerely trying to find their Dhamma in a lay context? Yes.
So sometimes I tell people that their place of their work, the place of their family, that's their monastery. And just think that they have a very strict abbot and a very difficult abbot they're working with. And I say that to really to encourage them, this counts. This is a valuable too. And as I said, I've been in Buddhist monasteries a lot. It's not just, you know, I don't know, but maybe it's different in the Clare Mountain. You guys, you know, because there's so few of you maybe. But most monasteries that I've been to, Buddhist places I've lived in and visited, from the outside, they look like everyone is, must be in some kind of bliss state in the clouds all the time. But on the inside, it's the people there really need to be there. And sometimes it's a hospital for people, and there's a lot of challenges and difficulties that are there. And so people have this expectation that, you know, being able to give yourself over fully to monastic life is the solution to everything. And then they discover they do that and it's all the same problems they had before. And so I think that, it's possible to validate practice in daily life as a serious place to practice and really go far. But it takes care, it takes attention, it takes dedication, but it can be done. And I'm inspired by people at IMC to watch people figure it out, on some of this on their own. And one example is that with pandemic, we started doing online retreats. And And I've known some of the senior practitioners here who are really deep practice. They'll come to some of these senior practitioners retreats online. And, you know, the old model was, well, you better just sit all practice all day long, you know, and just, this is their chance. And that's what's really at. But they couldn't do that. They were at home. They had children. They had work. And, but this is what they wanted to do. So in the corners of the day when they could, they would come to the Dharma talk. They'd come to the instructional sitting. They would drop in before going to bed. And that was actually very powerful to give them momentum of practicing in their life, because there's, you get kind of a, it's maybe an unfortunate term, a contact high to be around other people who are practicing like this and having those kinds of teachings. And since they have a deep practice of their own, they're reminded of it. And so it infuses them into their work, into their family life, even though they're not doing the full retreat. So I thought when I saw people starting to do that, I was so inspired. I you know, I was probably more narrow-minded before, and like, well, you have to practice all day long, and to see that people benefit from this. And now I'm very happy that people audit our retreats online, and then just figure out how it works for them. And I just trust them. Everyone's doing it the best they can. So I just want to trust that they'll find a way, as long as they don't disturb the people who are sitting silently all day.
Thank you.
You've got a new book called Everything is Practice.
Yeah.
I've not read it yet, but basically about how to approach retreat practice. But the title itself is quite provocative inspiring, actually, in the way that you were just speaking to. One of your essays is The Buddha as a Parent, not in that new book, but an earlier essay. And you yourself are a parent of two. Could you speak at all to how you bring the Dharma into your parenting?
Well, I might not be so good at answering your questions the way you ask. I don't know if I brought the Dharma into it. It's more like I brought the challenges of being parent and family life into the Dharma. When I first had a child, before that I would prepare my Dharma talks a lot. And then I had my kid and I couldn't have time anymore when he was a baby. So I still show up to teach the weekly talks I gave, but they weren't prepared. And also I was sleep deprived and harried, you know, and you know, these babies are difficult habits to have. And so I would come tired and unprepared. And I thought, oh no, you know, my Dharma talks have gotten really poor, really bad. And maybe they were, but people liked them a lot more. People resonated more with them because I think I was talking more from my own challenges than I had before. And so for me, being a parent, for me, monastic life was a love. It was maybe too easy for me. I sometimes thought it was a perfect lifestyle. I just loved the life there. And which is not the way some monastics experience it. But what was challenging was family life. And so it was invaluable to me as a person, as a practitioner, to have the opportunity to see where I was still attached, see places that I hadn't seen before, see my challenges. So because I had the habit of practicing and seeing and trying to be honest about myself, I was given a lot of opportunities to see aspects of myself that I had never addressed and looked at. And so I think I became a much better person because of it. And if I had stayed monastic, I would have spent more time in jhana, but I would have spent less time addressing some of the dark corners of my mind. So for who I was, this was really useful for me too. And it was, I didn't see it as apart from the practice. I saw it was as important to address this, to say yes to this too, and find my way through it.
Thank you, Gil. In terms of the circling back around to your intention to not turn away anyone, and I love that way of articulating your inability to bifurcate the world into those you should help and those you shouldn't. And I'm glad that you, you know, did so with a young Ajahn Kobilo years back.
bifurcated me well.
Yeah, well done. And one aspect of that that you've really carried out with a pretty amazing amount of integrity is holding to the Dana model in a way that is really shines. And would you talk about what that looks like at your centers, and
yes.
And what you would, you know, advise teachers in terms of the quote unquote Dana talk, or maybe a better angle would be to say, you know, how much vulnerability do you have to create before the world answers? Like, how much of a leap of faith has this been? Just if you would speak around this whole realm, that would be wonderful.
Yes, yes. So we have an amazing, inspiring kind of, what I don't call it Dana model anymore or Dana retreats or anything. I call it a culture of generosity. And I think that's better represents what we're doing. It's a culture of generosity we've developed slowly. In little steps for 30 years, we've created a whole culture. It's a whole way in which a community of people relate to each other, understand each other, and are motivated. And I started the group that I started. It was a sitting group that I joined to be the teacher for in 1990. And it was 12 people who came every Monday night. And slowly, slowly it built. But it was always, I was always dedicated to offering the teachings freely. Somehow that's what I picked up my 10 years of monastic life. Not to expect money, not to ask for it, just teach and things will take care of themselves. And so, but I was a graduate student at that point, and I had a lucrative stipend from university to live on, which was at the time, 1990, was $8,000 a year. And it's a lot more then than it is now. But still, I was able to get rent and food with that. And so I didn't have to depend on teaching for any kind of income. And so I was able to just teach freely and not think about it. And I did first couple of years, there was no Dana. It never occurred to me there was supposed to be. And then at some point there was. And at some point there was an idea that I could see after about teaching for 4 years or so, that about that time my scholarship had run out, and I was now being a TA to have an income. And I saw that the amount of that being a TA limited how much I could say yes to the invitations for teaching. And I didn't know if I could support my wife and I with not being a TA, just not have any employment and just teach. But that was a leap of faith. And I just, something said, this is what I should do. And I'll see what comes. And so I did. And to my surprise, over the next year, the income that I didn't get as a TA was made up from what people offered me. And it's very, I don't really like the Dana talk. I don't think that's really in the spirit of offering the teaching freely. So it's very rare that we mention at IMC Dana. Sometimes when we have guests, we'll, out of respect for the guests, we'll say, please remember the Dana basket. Occasionally we'll mention it to people, how it works. But it's very rare. So that on our retreats at IRC, we never have a Dana talk. For a long time, we had what we called the non-Dana talk. And then at some point I thought, you know, this is silly to define it that way. So now we call it the IRC appreciation talk. And it is a little bit motivated, I think, with integrity to support the idea that people would donate to IRC. But we never ask. But the idea is to inspire people about what IRC is. So it's kind of like the medium is the message. It's kind of like, you can take it for granted what's here, but we want to let you know what a wonderful thing it is and how we appreciate it so much and all the generosity and care and goodwill that's gone into everything here. And I say that with inspiration. I'm just so moved by what we have and what's happened. And then there's never an ask. You never say, oh, and by the way, you can do Dana. We just do this appreciation. And then people do what they want to do. And And over the years, because of this system, because it started slow and built slow, there's a lot of people understand it and really appreciate it. Mm. And in fact, I think that some of the financial support that IMC receives from people, is because we have this culture of generosity. They are so inspired by it. And so I'm very conservative about trying to maintain it as best I can. There's a lot of forces that are at play to change it. And so I'm probably more conservative than I should, but I feel like I have to hold the line to maintain it the way it is. Every year we do a fundraising letter for now. And for 25 years, we've done a fundraising letter. But if you read the fine print, or if you read it carefully, there's never an ask. It looks like a fundraising letter. It smells like one. If you shake it, it probably sounds like one. It has a remit envelope. But it's kind of like, I think of it a little bit like the Buddhist alms bowl. You don't go around waving and say, hey, look what I have here. Please give me food. Better from that restaurant than that one. You're just there with an open bowl without asking. So we're there with the open fundraising letter. Mm.
That's really beautiful. And when I first met you, I was impressed. I knew about your Dana model. And that's one of the reasons that I contacted you. And I find it very inspiring, as do, Lumpur Pasno really praises your, that model and yourself. Yeah. On this theme of Dana, so Dana is part, the efficacy of Dana or generosity is part of mundane right view. There is what is given, what is offered, what is sacrificed. Other parts of that mundane right view are there is some relationship between a child and their parents, that there is efficacy to good and bad action, that there is this world and the next world, which is a particular topic I'm not going to ask about now.
You know better.
Well, I will recommend people. There's a great essay called Should I Believe in Rebirth that Gil wrote, which is quite fascinating, a very good essay about this naturalistic approach to belief in rebirth. But the final part of mundane right view is that there are beings, samanas and brahmins, people who have realized for themselves, this world and the next world, basically people who have become enlightened. So this issue of believing in enlightenment seems actually more consequential than belief in rebirth. And I'm curious if you could speak to that. You spoke and wrote so eloquently about how one doesn't really need to believe in rebirth, but it seems the believing, is it possible to transcend greed, anger, and delusion? Ultimately, to fully transcend it, that seems like a consequential belief to take on or not.
Yeah. That's a belief that I have faith in, that it's possible, and I don't really know if it's possible, but it's my faith, and I have enough evidence of how thoroughly it can go that. It gives me, it's like the North Star, or it gives me the path. I know what's the path that can walk. I know where this path is going. I know it's going to the ultimate cessation of greed, hate, and delusion. And, whether anybody gets it to the end of the path, I don't know whether I'll ever get, I don't know. But I don't really care so much. I just really care about being on the path. That's what's important. And I'll do the best I can. I'll go as far as I can go. And maybe I'll be surprised. But I'm just very happy to, very content and very happy to be on it the way I am.
So Gil, I'm going to have to duck out in just a few minutes to open the Zoom session, although Ajahn Kobilo may keep you on here for a few minutes. But if I can follow up on that question and circle back around to the stream entry question, because that's a good one. So though it might be enough to feel like you're aligned with the path in the moment, I am curious about these landmarks the Buddha laid out where there's something discrete and real that's shifted in the heart. Is this something that you believe, you know, how would you talk to people about that experience and about knowing its authenticity or not?
Yes. I think now I understand politicians a little bit, why they don't answer the question directly. Not because I'm being politician, but I'm inspired to respond slightly differently. And so maybe allow me to do that. And then you can always come back and ask again if you think I'm being evasive or something. But it might be interesting to know that after I was teaching a Vipassana teacher for about 10, 12 years, I was very happy with how I taught, kind of. But it was a little bit of a synthesis of a kind of a, maybe we can call it a non-dual approach of Zen and Vipassana. There was more the kind of imminent mindfulness that Bhikkhu Bodhi was talking about, where the point was just really to show up for the present moment in an accepting, full, wholehearted way. And that can be profound. I saw doing the Mahasi practice in Burma, how profound that is when you do it thoroughly with a lot of concentration. But somehow after 12 years of teaching, I said, well, this is fine and good, but where are the deep practitioners? And I didn't feel like everyone had to be a deep practitioner, but there needs to be a few every generation. We need to have some to know the potential of the mind and freedom. And so where are they? And so in the 1990s, I studiously avoided using words like stream entry. And then slowly, then in the aughts and I slowly started to talk more and more about the potential of possibilities. And I even have a program now, the year-long program called Entering the Stream, which in the 1990s would have been heretical for the 1990s Gill. I want to let people know there's more is possible, that you can practice more thoroughly. There's a possibility of greater liberation and freedom. And have that as your North Star. Have that as an inspiration. Really practice thoroughly and well. Know that's possible. And the art of it for me is I still feel like everyone has to experience that. There's a lot of ways of maturing in the Dharma. And I don't want to hold up a particular experience, a particular level as the thing. So I'm still a little bit hedging it all and trying not to kind of, but I'm much more goal-oriented in how I talk now. But that also has a problem. You can't, you know, it's very, very hard to be a Buddhist teacher because no matter what you say, you know, you're probably saying only one side of it. And so anyway, so now I've kind of swung towards the more, much more. So now I'm more clear in talking about it and stream entry and I've come to appreciate much more then this great value of my suttas that I've done is to start to discerning how the Buddha talked about post-stream entry practice. That practice changes after stream entry. And then it made sense. Now I understood something about the practice that I'd intuited, but no one ever told me about, and no one had guided me. And so this idea I even teach sometimes about post-stream entry practice and, you know, how things shift and change with that experience. It's not just the experience of it. Sometimes I've seen, like at the Mahasi Center in Burma, it was all about stream entry. But then once you had stream entry, you were just left alone. And, you know, to flounder, you can come back and practice if you wanted or something. But I think that we do people a disservice because people who have stream entry or something like that, it's really important to validate it or appreciate it, value it, to help them see what's changed and how they can continue practicing and how their practice changes after stream entry. So I went on and on. You want to try asking the question again?
No, that was great, Gil. And I admit, I'm so tempted to ask you more about the post-stream entry practice, and perhaps Ajahn Kovila will get into that, but I do have to go host the Zoom room right now. We'll let Ajahn Kovila ask you questions here for a bit longer, and then he'll post the Zoom link in the chat when everyone's ready to jump over.
Great.
But just to say, one aspect of stream entry is, you know, it says, the Buddha says it's impossible that a stream enterer would not feel gratitude. And we really acknowledge what we owe you, and Buddhism in the West and in the US owe you in terms of seeding this ground, which we stepped into, and just really grateful for that, Gil. So thank you so much for joining us, and please come visit us in Seattle sometime.
I would love to do that. And I'm actually quite touched by your gratitude, and quite touched that you would kind of, you know, I'm getting to be an old man, and because I've been around a lot. And lately, just recently, I got another appreciation about, you know, all the stuff that I've done. And it actually touched me, it touched my heart in a very nice way. And I was kind of surprised by it. And so it's well received. Thank you.
Yeah, you landed an Ajahn Kovila with us, at least in part. So that's definite points in your karmic book. So I do have to go, but I will ask one final question, which I'm going to let you answer when I'm gone, so that I will definitely come back and listen. In a recent interview, you talked about encountering a commune when you were young of 700 people, and their daily, or their, I don't know if it's daily, but their sacrament was LSD, but they kept getting arrested and looked for a substitute for that sacrament, and finally came to honesty as their substitute. So could you talk more about that?
Yes, and, I'd love to.
And now I'm going to leave and let you answer that when I'm gone.
Great. Yeah, I'd love to talk about that. So it was a commune that had its genesis in San Francisco, San Francisco in the mid-60s. There was a professor named Stephen Guskin, an English professor, who took a lot of LSD and started. He hung out with Zen Master Suzuki Roshi, and then he started teaching, and a lot of hippies started to hang out with him. And then they did this huge cross-country caravan of school buses, and got stopped at almost every state border because they were so bizarre. But, you know, these hundreds of hippies and school buses was just too much for the police to manage. But then they decided to set in that trip cross country, they decided to buy land in Tennessee and settle there, of all places. And they realized at some point that it didn't work to continue with taking LSD in Tennessee. And actually the leaders of the community got arrested and spent a year in jail. So they had to find something else. And what they found was honesty. And when I went there, they were practicing it. And I was only going to be there for 3 days to visit. And I was just blown away to witness people who had a practice of honesty, and the people who were skilled at it didn't have to say much. Sometimes they would just wink at each other, and everyone understood that what had just happened. Someone said something; it wasn't right, and somehow it was highlighted and named. But people who are newer to it, then there would be long, hours-long conversations. Until everyone understood what was going on and the honesty could be finally admitted or allowed. And so they got better and better. People are there. It's being very truthful and finding a way through it. And that's why I stayed. And before that, I being there, I don't think I had any spiritual or religious real interest. I had done TM meditation a little bit, but, you know, I didn't. I was probably grew up a little bit anti-religious, but the farm. The place is called the Farm. The Farm in Tennessee, they presented themselves as a spiritual community, and that the spiritual practice was honesty. And that's when I first thought, well, wow. I mean, this spiritual thing maybe has something going for it. And there, the Bible of the farm was the book Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And that book spoke to me really deeply. And it was like I read the book and it's like, wow, these are things I know but didn't know I knew. And there was that intimate or that personal. And so then I went eventually into San Francisco Zen Center to do Zen practice. And I valued that tremendously. But I was very disappointed too, because I'd expected the same level of honesty, practice of honesty there that I had at the farm in Tennessee. But it wasn't there. That's not the specialty of Zen Center. And they have a lot of good, there's a lot of positives there. But the level of consistent, just really showing up to be honest, was not there. And so I had to do my Zen practice with, you know, coping with that.
Yeah. One, this emphasis and not shying away from morality in the precepts is something which I think both of us really are impressed with about IMC and your teaching as well. Just one of your recent talks called An Ethics Bath, just meditating on one's own goodness, at least while one's meditating. I'm curious, one of your other recent talks, you're describing your particular take on the Dharma, and you talk about an aspect of natural care, where you talk about this belief that there's a natural movement towards love and evolving of the heart. And that's beautiful. And I am curious what you would say there, you know, there, that's true. It definitely can be true. I'm curious about, say for people that don't feel like it's a natural process. You know, I think there's a sutta quote, something to the effect of, for people who are used to doing good, who are of a habitual habit of, you know, keeping precepts, it's easy to keep precepts and it's hard to break the precepts. But for someone who's of a habit to break precepts, it's easy to break the precepts and it's hard to keep the precepts. So does that natural tendency also exist in the opposite direction, or relate to that seeming possibility that it goes both ways, that there's a natural tendency towards good and a possibility towards, yeah, really breaking down?
Well, I think that the important part of Buddhist practice is contributing conditions to our life. And I'm not so big on the idea of causality, that we cause things, but that we create the conditions for some natural process to unfold. So if we spend our time hanging out with thieves all the time, it might be the conditions for us to become a thief. But if we spend our time all the time with the people who are working in soup kitchens and feeding the hungry, then it might be natural. We have the conditions where that inspires us and that speaks to us in some way. If we have the condition of always swearing, that creates a certain condition that goes in a certain direction. If we refrain from swearing, that creates different conditions. And so we're trying to put together the right conditions. And so whatever conditions we put, then there's kind of a natural movement in some direction. So whether it's wholesome or unwholesome depends on the conditions we add to it. Mm-hmm. I showed up and met for a sex addict recovery group. I'd never been to a recovery group before, but they asked me to come to that particular group. And for them, I said that meditation is the act of continual care for yourself. And so, because I wanted to contextualize the conditions for someone who's struggling with addiction, that can create more beneficial conditions for them to move their life in a different direction. And if meditation is meant, you better get into samadhi, into jhana, or you're not really up to snuff, that'll probably make the conditions for them to feel more despairing and more maybe using their addiction to try to soothe themselves. But if they understand the meditation is the continual act of care, that got their attention. And, you know, oh, no matter what, care, love. So I think that there's a lot of natural movements, but we want to choose the ones that are wholesome.
That's beautiful, Gil. I might just have one more question. We didn't, I think people in the chat were just praising, just loving your answers and no questions yet, but I have one maybe final question just about, I mean, you do lots of teachings, and this past week you've been doing readings from your own translations of the Therigatha, these teachings of the old elder nuns. And this is, you know, Ajahn Tanisaro sometimes jokes that Rumi is the American Buddhist poet laureate. And that you do find that a lot of quoting, but not always from the Buddha, which is fine. But, you really do consistently take it back. You've written a book called The Buddha Before Buddhism, your translation of the Atthakavagga of the Sutta Nipata. And, could you just talk to that aspect of your practice and how you encourage it in others?
You mean the practice of the suttas or reading or what?
Exactly. Yeah. Going back to the suttas, readings and the value of that.
Yeah. So there's two reasons, I think maybe three reasons why I do love the suttas and like going back to them. One is that, it has proved really good for my own practice. I've understood my own practice and how to practice, how to go forward from what I've encountered there. It's inspired me, it's taught me, it's guided me. So that's been good. I find fantastic material for teaching. And as I've understood better in the suttas, I have more to teach my students. And so, and in some ways, because I keep still studying and discovering more and practicing more, sometimes I think I can keep the teaching more fresh because it's a little bit new and it's growing, it's developing, hopefully. And then the other is that I feel, if I call myself a Buddhist, a Theravadan Buddhist, I feel like I am accountable to the tradition in some way. And I want to respect it, and I want to, so the translation of them is a way of trying, what I'm trying to do, it may be an impossible task for a translator, but to trying the best I can to understand the ancients in their own terms and let them speak for themselves and find out what's going on there. And by doing this, by studying the suttas, I do see how much even some of the translations that we have, and certainly it's a lot of the teachings that are based in the suttas, how interpretive they are. And there's layers and layers of interpretation that we've received from the tradition, from scholars and different things that have really biased how we read the suttas. It's a big task to break through those biases and really see what's there. And so I think I'm able to do some of that better now. And I feel it's respectful. It's helps my greater growth. And I don't necessarily feel like I have to believe it or teach exactly what I see, agree with it all. But I feel like I am accountable to it. And if I do differ from that, I want to be responsible for that difference. And I think all teachers in the United States, probably every teacher, every generation, everywhere, is changing the teaching, adapting it, reinterpreting it. But I want to be responsible for that process. Mm-hmm. And so studying the suttas helps with that.
I've got one final question. I think, can we do one more question?
We can. Everyone on Zoom was just watching the interview, as was I, so I just came back. The Zoom room is open when people want to jump on, but we'll just keep staying here until it's finished.
Well, this question did jump out. So someone says, please ask him about rebirth, please. And it is curious, that essay, Should I Believe in Rebirth, was very well written, and I have to say that I come from a very similar place to yourself, raised by atheists and, you know, raised with a belief in science, and your framing of naturalistic Buddhism is attractive in many ways. One thing you say in that essay is that you don't see a reason for believing in rebirth. And then you say later on that for your own motivation, you give many reasons why you don't see a reason for believing in rebirth. One of which is that for you, believing just in one life is actually better motivation Like you say that some people, if you believe in multiple lives, you say, oh, I'll get around to practicing next life or the life after that, which I think some people do fall into that. But for myself, so very similar to you, you know, do I believe in rebirth? I can answer, I can check that box off, you know, if asked being, you know, tested on it by Sangha authorities. I want to believe in rebirth. It's in the suttas. I believe I have met people who are enlightened who teach it as if it's a real thing. I have no experience of it. But it's in the suttas, and wise people I know feel like they praise it. And for me, it does provide a sense of motivation. Like if I was not afraid of negative consequences and didn't believe in the, then I don't think I would practice as hard. There's something called the lokadipateya, which is the governing principle of the world, where one practices because they have this thought, oh, maybe the devas are watching. You know, one, you know, is maybe more moral, or they practice meditation more, because they think, oh, who knows who's watching me right now? So for me, that is a motivation. And so that's all just to say, could you say anything more about rebirth, please?
Rebirth. I forget, you know, what I write. It's so many things. So if in that article about should I believe in rebirth, if I said something like, you know, there's no reason to believe in it, I think I was, hopefully I was talking about myself. Other people, I know there are other people have reasons to believe in it, and it's useful for some people. I don't want to deny people that. So again, I don't know exactly how to pick up the question, but lately I haven't finished doing this research, but there's plenty of times in the sutta where when the word jati, birth, is not used literally, but used as a metaphor. So the birth of a mental construction, birth of a thought, the birth of greed, the birth of ordinary things in everyday life. And so could it be that some of the ways that Paticca Samuppada is understood, the wheel of dependent arising, that it's not meant to be three lifetimes, but it's really just the describing a process that exists in this very lifetime here, and that jati there is, you know, it's a metaphor rather than the literal idea of jati, of birth. Mm. So I don't know the answer to this, I don't have I don't have any motivation to counter anybody who says they believe in rebirth, and respect it, the belief. I respect the way some people hold it, but the way that it works for me now personally is, you know, that I don't feel a need to believe in it, and that's enough for me. But as a Buddhist teacher, you know, kind of representing the tradition, all this stuff, the question is, how do I hold some of these teachings like rebirth respectfully? And mm-hmm. mostly I just try to ignore it and hope people don't ask me the question.
Until two monks get you on an interview.
Gil.
It's fine. Yes.
You are so good at not holding on to views. Well, we have people, I think, who are excited to join us over on Zoom. So anyone here, I'm inserting the link into the chat. And people who, just putting that in the chat now. And anyone who wants to. Oh, sorry.
So I click on that, and then both windows will stay open then? Is that the idea?
Not yet. So what we'll do is we'll begin wrapping stuff up. And after we close, there'll be another link which we'll have ready for you. So,
okay. So I shouldn't click on that now.
Yeah. Hold tight.
Okay.
But everybody else can go over there. And, Gil, such a pleasure and speaking with you. My mother lives in Palo Alto, as I said. So I hope to come and see you and visit IMC next time I visit, but a real pleasure.
Very nice. That would be very nice to see you. Let me know if you're coming down, and I'll try to make time again.
That would be fabulous.
Gil, we so appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay. See you over on Zoom.